This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel. The Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 5. Nobody confessed to the crime. Nobody claimed to have witnessed the murder. The case against Leo Frank was based on circumstantial evidence. There was facts and there was testimony that were considered in a trial. But what they considered was what was the most likely sequence of events, since nobody stood up and said, I did it and this is how I did it. They had to try to make sense out of different and sometimes conflicting opinions about what happened. Who had the motive? Who had the opportunity? Are the big questions that a detective and a prosecutor ask and ask the jury to consider. This time, I want to focus on Leo Frank and his behavior and testimony as to his character and his reputation. These are the things that led to him being suspected and arrested in the first place, and these are the things that ultimately led to his conviction. Just to review, the last time I talked about an article that had been written in the 1990s by Stephen Goldfarb, and he titled it Framed, and that was his claim in a word that Leo Frank had been framed. And I just want to review that because of I can't get over the breathtaking leaps of logic and how that violates the principle that I just described as to how a trial based on circumstantial evidence actually occurs and the good faith in which they expect both the people who are arguing for prosecution and for the defense and for the jury who is judging the arguments, how it's supposed to work and how the argument that Stephen Goldfarb presented was completely different than that. And as I just said, it's involve these breathtaking leaps of logic. The fact that he presented what he was talking about as if it was some newly discovered thing, when it was really just an obscure but not unknown peripheral lawsuit that had occurred. It wasn't unknown to the people of the day and didn't cause them to change their minds about Leo Frank. And it had to do, according to him, according to Goldfarb, with the claim that Harry Scott didn't do his job, that the private investigator didn't do his job. And it was motivated in reality by the fact that they didn't want to pay their bills. So there's a motive for them making such an argument. That doesn't necessarily mean that Harry Scott actually didn't do his job properly. And in fact, that's the way the court decided is they decided in the on Harry Scott, to believe Harry Scott or his lawyers anyway. The other argument was that Scott ultimately, the argument got to the point where Goldfarb said that Scott had conspired and collaborated to railroad Frank along with the prosecutor. Well, first of all, that's the prosecutor's job was to prosecute. So there's no surprise there that he tried to prosecute Frank. And the fact that Scott changed his mind and joined the prosecution really doesn't deserve to be described in terms like conspire and collaborate and railroad. Those all have negative connotations that aren't deserved. But that's how Jews do what they do and how Goldfarb did what he did. They use words like this, these loaded words, without really any cause for them. And two phrases that he used toward the conclusion of his article, that the claim that Frank did not receive a fair trial for a crime that he almost certainly did not commit, there's a leap of logic right there. Now, why would anything that Goldfarb had presented, even if it was all true, mean that Frank hadn't committed the crime? It doesn't. It just means that there was something wrong with somebody else. It doesn't mean that Frank was innocent. And in the end, he said the conclusion that Frank was railroaded is inescapable. And it's only in Goldfarb's mind and the mind of other Jews that come to the defense of Frank. Instead of putting Harry Scott or Hugh Dorsey on trial, which is what Goldfarb was attempting to do, to shift the blame away from Leo Frank, in this installment I want to examine more closely why Frank was on trial. It wasn't for no reason whatsoever, and it wasn't for Jew hate or any other supposedly irrational reason. There were very good reasons. And in fact, I want to pick up where I left off the last time, which is talking about an article titled 100 Reasons Leo Frank is Guilty, which the point of which is not that there were actually 100 different reasons listed, but that there are many reasons to believe that Leo Frank was guilty that have little to do with Harry Scott's contribution or even the prosecutor and whether the prosecutor was a bad guy or not. So this is an article from the American Mercury. Reason number 38, and this gets to Frank's demeanor, the nervousness and contradictions, the items here that I've gathered to discuss here right at the beginning. Item 38, former county policeman Boots Rogers, who drove the officers to Frank's home and then took them all, including Frank, back to the factory on the morning of April 27th. That's the day after the murder, the day the body was discovered. Said Frank was so nervous that he was hoarse, even before being told of the murder. Item 41 refers, I think, to the same event, the same person. Anyway, when Leo Frank accompanied the officers to the police station later on during the day after the murder, Rogers stated that Leo Frank was literally so nervous that his hands were visibly shaking. So two indications there, really, that he was hoarse before he was even told what had happened, and that he was visibly, his hands were visibly shaking at the scene of the crime. Items 2 through 9 in the list also get to Frank's nervousness. I don't want to bother reading each individual item. And to a few of the contradictions that Frank committed early on in the investigation that led to attention being called to himself. You know, in the Goldfarb's piece, he made a big deal out of the supposed contradictions of Harry Scott, the Pinkerton investigator, but there was really, it was all based on one main contradiction, which was, or a change of mind, which was that Harry Scott changed his mind. He at first he thought he was working for Leo Frank to find some other murderer, and then he found out it was Leo Frank and decided to help with the conviction of Frank. And you know, Goldfarb was just waving his hands away to distract attention from that main change and pay attention to little details that were less important that sprang from that main change. In this case, each of these little contradictions of Frank's actually add to the case, to the consistency of the case against Frank, that Frank was nervous, that he was contradicting himself, and it called attention to him that ultimately led to other things being uncovered that led to his conviction. One of the items was, I think I've mentioned it already before, another young girl who worked at the factory, the pencil factory, Montine Stover, had come to see Frank right about at the time. It was right after Mary Fagan had been to visit him, supposedly, and she didn't find him there in the office. He claimed not to have seen her either, but, and this is where items 12 and 13 say Frank testifies he might have gone to the bathroom, and the bathroom was in the metal room in the back of that same floor that his office was on, and that's the room in which Mary Fagan worked, And that's the room in which, ultimately, just to insert some details here that were uncovered during the trial, the body was discovered down in the basement by the night watchman, Newt Lee. And he was initially suspected, but he was eventually cleared. Circumstances indicated that he couldn't have been the one who murdered her. But Jim Conley, the sweeper, the Negro sweeper in the building, testified later that he was told by Frank to take the body from the bathroom in the metal room and to take it down to the furnace down in the basement in order to burn it, and that he would be paid extra to do that. And he was sort of a gopher, he testified to in the trial, a gopher for Frank, that he did Frank's bidding, and having to do with Frank's activities with young ladies that we'll get into more details about here. But this list of 100 reasons makes quite a big deal, and another document that I'll cite in a bit here also makes a big deal out of this testimony that Frank gave about going to the bathroom, that he might have gone to the bathroom, because, and it was one of his contradictions as well, because early on in the inquest phase of the investigation, he claimed he didn't go to the bathroom, that he had been at his desk the whole time. And so that was one of the contradictions that came out during the trial of Frank's. And of course, the explanation for this contradiction is that he was busy murdering Mary Fagan in the back room, in the metal room. That's where it occurred. That's where the body was found. That's where hair was found and blood was found on the floor. Let's see. Item number 14 was that Frank testified that Fagan had left, had come into his office. He talked to her and then she left. And he testified that he heard her talking with another girl outside his office. And the strange thing is that that other girl was never identified. The defense team, whose obligation it would have been to find that girl and present her, never did. So just a mystery girl, and nobody ever came forward to say, hey, I was the girl who talked to her. Now, we get to some items here about Leo Frank's, quote, bad moral character, unquote, or the purported history of perversion of Leo Frank, the perverted things that he was doing outside of his job as manager of this pencil factory. So item 98 in the list, so way down toward the end of the list of 100 items, it says, why did the Leo Frank defense team, consisting of some of the most skilled attorneys in the state, refuse to cross-examine 20 young women and girls who testified that Frank had a bad moral character? Now, recall that right at the very end, almost tacked on because I just had a few minutes left to speak the last time, I did talk about the testimony. There were a couple of items from this same list about specific girls that had testified that Frank had made passes at them and that they had refused. So here we see that there were actually 20. I don't know if those two were included in this number 20, but that there were 20 other young women, or maybe all in total, that testified in a similar fashion to his bad moral character. But it says, it goes on here, under Georgia law, the prosecution was only allowed to use these witnesses' testimony to enter the general fact that Frank's character was bad. Under cross-examination, though, the defense could have forced the girls and women to give specific reasons and relate specific incidents that supported their opinion and trip them up if they could. Why, then, did they not do so? The only reasonable answer, they knew Leo Frank's character, and they did not dare allow any specifics to go before the jury. Now, we're going to get into Frank's life, and specifically his wife and his marriage, because Frank was a married man. And the fact that he was supposedly fooling around outside of his marriage is scandalous, and it speaks to his character. And if somebody is willing to do that, well, then maybe they're more likely to murder someone, is probably the argument that was made during the trial. It's one of the thoughts, of course, that comes to my mind. Item 86 from the list focuses on his wife. Her name was Lucille Selig, is her maiden name, Frank. Lucille Selig Frank. Leo Frank's wife is known as a fiercely loyal spouse who passionately defended her husband against charges both criminal and moral and stood by his side during his trial and appeals. There are some indications, however, that she may have, early on during the Mary Fagan case, believed that her husband had not been entirely faithful and had, in fact, killed Mary Fagan, probably believing it to be accidental. Long after her husband's death, she may have returned to those views. And embedded in this, at this point in that document, is a photo, a black and white, looks like a sketch, of a pretty unpleasant-looking woman. That was my first reaction, that she's kind of ugly. And I then looked up other photos of her that were actual photos and clearer. And she's got dark hair. She's got a kind of round face, chubby face, and with Chinese eyes, epicanthic folds over her eyes that make her look kind of Chinese. In fact, she struck me as looking very similar to our Supreme Court Justice, the proud Latina Sonia Sotomayor, who is apparently partially Jewish, crypto-Jewish. So there's a bit of a family resemblance there, I would guess. Mrs. Leo Frank, in 1913, this is the caption on that photo that I said makes her look like an unpleasant-looking woman. It's from 1913. Is it conceivable that her 29-year-old husband, surrounded every working day by over 150 young women and teenage girls over which he had absolute authority, was unfaithful? So that's, in a nutshell, the suggestion and the argument. And I get the impression that that suggestion and that argument wasn't really fleshed out in the trial itself, that this is speculation after the fact, because it was probably considered so scandalous that they didn't really want to go there. It was enough to call into question through the testimony of a few women who had passes made at them, and they considered that enough. They didn't dig into some of the details that I'll allude to here and go over fairly quickly. I don't want to dwell on it either because it isn't part of the trial. It isn't part of the documented history. And so it's a little bit speculative. And in this regard, I don't feel any need really to get into speculative bits of evidence. I don't mind speculating about motives, especially of why Jews came to Leo Frank's defense and why they continued to try and invert reality to protect him and protect their tribe. That I don't mind. But speculating about evidence, there's no need to. There's a huge amount of evidence against Leo Frank as it is. But we will touch on a little bit here, some of it. And the main thing is what's called State's Exhibit J. And this is mentioned right in this item number 86. This is one of those items that is actually more than one paragraph. It's toward the end of the list of 100, and it's several paragraphs. In fact, it says, State's Exhibit J at Leo Frank's trial consisted of an affidavit by Manola McKnight, Frank's black cook. Mrs. McKnight, first came to the attention of the authorities when her husband told police that his wife had heard some startling revelations while working at the Frank residence the evening of the murder, namely that Leo Frank had drunkenly and remorsefully admitted to his wife that he and a girl had been caught at the factory, that he didn't know why he would murder her, and that he asked his wife Lucille to get him a pistol so he could kill himself. These are are Manola McKnight's own words from the affidavit. Sunday, Miss Lucille said to Mrs. Selig, Mrs. Selig is Lucille Frank's mother. They lived in the same house. That Mr. Frank didn't rest so good Saturday night. She said he was drunk and he wouldn't let her sleep with him. Now, this is the night that the murder took place. He had gotten drunk and didn't let her sleep with him. Miss Lucille said Sunday, the next day, that Mr. Frank told her Saturday night that he was in trouble and that he didn't know the reason why he would murder, and he told his wife to go get his pistol and let him kill himself. When I left home to go to the Solicitor General's office, they told me to mind how I talked. They pay me $3.50 a week. But last week they paid me $4. And 1 week she paid me $6.50. And then there's a long paragraph about several weeks and the different pays that she got higher than usual. But the paragraph concludes, I understand that it was a tip for me to keep quiet. They would tell me to mind how I talked, and Miss Lucille gave me a hat. So it was an attempt to buy off the maid, the housekeeper, the cook, this mammy, I guess was the Southern expression for it, this black servant in the house. And let's go on here. It says, Leo Frank also admitted that he bought a box of chocolates for his wife on the way home on the evening of the day of the murder. So this is what happened after the murder. He came home with chocolates and he got drunk. Manola McKnight would tell a different story after she was back at the Frank household, however. She then repudiated her affidavit and said police had coerced it from her. So she changed her story ultimately after she, you know, what caused her to go and give this statement to the police. She says it was the police twisting her arm or treating her to a third degree, coercing it. But I don't know. It's not believable. And it alludes here to why it's not all that believable. Neither she nor anybody else gave a credible motive for her husband to have lied, because apparently it was her husband that actually tipped off the police that his wife, Manola, had something to tell, that he told what she had told him, which is, I guess, hearsay, but it's a little complicated. But the husband of the servant had been told by her of what had happened, and he told police that. So there's a statement of his that I don't think he ever repudiated. He never withdrew. And apparently that was not coerced, and there was never any claim made that he had been coerced to make his statement. After Leo Frank's arrest, Lucille did not visit her husband for some 13 days, after which she began her loyal and indomitable defense of him. So at first she seemed to hesitate for 2 weeks, as if, you know, she was mad at him. And this 100-item list makes quite a bit of that, and several other items too. I don't know what to think about it other than, you know, she, assuming that this affidavit is right and that her husband actually confessed to doing it, that she was upset for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks of feeling bad about it, she decided to, you know, out of solidarity for her tribe at least, put on a good appearance and look like the loyal wife. And that's been visible in other cases where the defendant is probably guilty, even admits guilt, that we've seen in recent times where the wife stands with her husband. I think of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton as one example of that. Even though she knows that he's guilty, she does it for the expediency of it for herself and her own, or some other consideration other than necessarily loyalty or believing that, in this case, that Frank was innocent. Lucille Frank died in 1957. And in her will, she specifically directed that she be cremated and thus not buried next to or with her first and only husband, Leo Frank, even though the plot had already been provided for next to him. There was an empty spot there for her. Now, one thing about this kill himself claim, I think it's an interesting thing. You know, why would the black maid make that up? And let's assume it's not made up. Why would he say that? And I think it's because he wanted to save his family or his broader tribe or his business from disgrace. All three of those things, maybe. Because I think if he wanted to just kill himself, well, why not just confess? And then they would have sentenced him to death and he would have been killed. No need to shoot himself. But he didn't do that. And I think it, you know, if he wanted to just save himself the pain, he would have done that. Whereas what his overriding concern was to not, you know, bring the shame on his family and his tribe and his business. So I think that's why, even though that was something that he might have considered at first, maybe evidence that he wasn't a completely pathological, that he had some shred of a conscience, that he didn't do it in the end, and that's maybe why. Now, there's a page at leofrank.org that actually goes into quite a bit about Leo Frank's wife. It's an entire page dedicated to her titled The Biography of Mrs. Lucille Selig Frank. I'm not happy very much with this document. It looks like it was put together this year because although there's a lot on the page and there's a lot of details, and I'll try to summarize what I discovered, there's two things I don't like about it. It's not polished. It's not very well done. It's patchworky. It throws a lot of different things together in a kind of almost random order, and it's very redundant and repetitive in the arguments that it lays out. It basically says the same things over and over and over again. It's almost as if the guy who wrote it, the woman who wrote it, never edited it down to try and make some sense out of it. It looks more like notes almost. It also uses this, the other main reason that I don't really like it very much is it really puts an emphasis on this idea of Frank's confession. It's actually in the subtitle of the article is Leo Frank Murder Confession Number 2 of 4 Known, as if Leo Frank confessed the murder. And that's what I don't like about it. It's an off-putting rhetorical device. Leo Frank never admitted his guilt. He never flat out admitted, I did it, I murdered her. What they're trying to do with this rhetorical device is it's a misnomer, or it's a mislabeling of what's more precisely called incriminating statements, things that Frank did. And in this case, they're talking, for instance, the main one I've seen them refer to is the fact that he said, I may have gone to the bathroom in the metal room when that other girl came to visit and she couldn't find me in my office. That's an example of one of the four supposed Leo Frank confessions. That's not a confession. That's just an incriminating statement that adds to the circumstantial evidence against Leo Frank. So done picking nits with that. Lucille Selig Frank, I've already mentioned, her father's name was Selig. That's where she got that surname. That's an Ashkenazic name. It's German. It means blessed. Her mother's name was Josephine Cohen, was her maiden name. And Cohen is a Sephardic name, it's described as, which is not all that true. It's really a canonic Jewish surname that sort of predates the whole split between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews. And it's a surname that's associated with the priestly class of Jews. The Jewiest of Jews are Cohens. And so that was the mother of Lucille Frank, Leo's wife. Lucille's maternal grandfather, that would be her mother's father, Levi Cohen, was a religious pioneer who had helped found the first synagogue in Georgia. Josephine was, like most married women, a privilege from good families, and she was a pampered housewife with her very own daytime Negro mammy. The Selig family house-based benefited from the employment of 20-year-old Magnolia, quote-unquote Manola, McKnight, who served as their daytime cook and maid for 2 years from 1911 to 1913, with Manola taking care of the laundry. Well, it's about, you know, basically how easy her life was in having a servant. By 1913, the Selig clan was amongst the most prominent respected Jewish families in Atlanta, Georgia. This is the background of Leo Frank's wife, and it's speculated that he was just marrying for ambition and not so much for her looks. And that's why he was maybe dallying.